In a statement about the 2020 election last weekend, former President Donald Trump falsely claimed that his vice president could have overturned the election. It's after he suggested he might pardon January 6th rioters should he become president again. Here he is at a rally in Texas on Saturday.
If I run and if I win, we will treat those people from January 6th fairly. We will treat them fairly. And if it requires pardons, we will give them pardons because they are being treated so unfairly.
This comes as reporting is shedding new light on strategies that Trump and his advisors considered and attempted in order to keep Trump in office despite his election loss. We're taking a closer look at these stories, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about the state of elected government in America? Do stories about the 2020 election and its aftermath make you worry more? Do you think we need to make changes to strengthen democratic institutions like voting and elections? What do you think as you hear more details trickling in about the days between the November 2020 election and January 6th of the next year? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jeffrey Engel is a history professor and founding director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University. Jeff, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's good to talk to you.
Before we dig into some of the individual particular stories here, you've been quoted in the news saying that you're worried that the American people may be getting numb to this steady disclosure of facts, maybe not seeing the big picture and how serious it is.
I think that's true. I think that we are suffering from a couple of problems here as a nation. The first, of course, and I'm hardly the first person to say this, is our diffuse and divided media ecosystems. So if you are watching, you know, one television program, let's say MSNBC, you probably have heard a lot about the January 6th event. I like to call it insurrection. If you're watching Fox News or another right-wing media outlet, you probably are not concerned with it. You're probably more concerned with something else that they are focusing on. So we have half the population essentially hearing about a problem and half not. And then the second aspect of what makes Americans, I think, numb to this is that we've been through 5 years of a great deal of presidential news. Let's put it that way. The president was a much more active figure under the Trump administration in your personal daily lives and your conversations, frankly, I would argue, than almost any other time in American history. So after 5 years with competing ecosystems and competing elements of news coming out constantly, there's only so many times that the American public can be shocked into action, shocked into even answering the beep on their phone that tells them there's something new. So the fact that we have something very important going on in trying to understand what happened at the end of the election, after the election, and January 6th, the fact that that's very, very important doesn't mean that Americans essentially still have the energy to keep up with the pace of events.
President Trump talked in that Texas rally about the idea of he'd wished that Vice President Pence had overturned the election. Some of the language in the past had been, at least in public, taking more time to investigate allegations of fraud. Is it significant that the O word, overturn word, came out?
You know, I actually don't think so, except in the sense that it's going to cause us to hopefully have these conversations. So I appreciate that aspect of it. But former President Trump is not one to particularly choose his words wisely often. As we know, one of the major downfalls of his White House was his own proclivity to say things that were inappropriate or would grab headlines of the kind that he didn't want. So I don't think it's necessarily important that Trump has used the word overturn. What is significant is the amount of information that's coming out that shows that that's exactly what he designed to do. That's exactly what he wanted to do after November of the election, when it became clear that he did not win. The number of times and different ways and different manifestations of policies designed to do just that, overthrow a duly accredited election, are astounding. There really is no precedent for it in American history. And I want to be careful when I say that, because, you know, as a historian, we always tell our students not to use the word unprecedented, because usually it just means you're not trying hard enough. If you look further, you can find something. I can't find any parallel to a president so actively rejecting the voice of the people in their national vote.
One of the particulars that's come out over the last couple of weeks has been a talk of seizing voting machines, and then President Trump inquiring about that, encouraging the idea first from the Justice Department, the Defense Department, Homeland Security, trying to find an avenue to seize voting machines in especially battleground states. What are you seeing there? What do you make of those disclosures?
Again, I don't mean to be hyperbolic about it, but this is actually terrifying. This is what governments that are uninterested in being democratic or listening to the voice of the people do. They seize the ballot boxes. I'll give you a great example from American history, in a sense, which is that one of the reasons that the United States went into Panama in 1989 to depose Manuel Noriega was because he had done just that. His troops had taken all the ballot boxes. And once they're in somebody else's possession, you know, it's hard to know who's stuffing what. So, you know, once you have, in essence, the government being able to determine not just who won in a freer and fair way, but essentially using force to impose its own decision-making on the ballot boxes, that's a very, very dangerous thing. That's very typical of the way that fascist organizations operate and retain power. You know, again, I hate to be use exaggerated hyperbolic words, but this is actually a rejection of democracy. And especially since we know that there were no federal statutes that would have given the president authority to do this, whether in the Justice Department or the Department of Homeland Security or the Pentagon. And if you think back on the moments in the weeks that passed after the election, one of the most significant events to my mind was the resignation of the Attorney General, William Barr. William Barr, who had done as much, if not more, than anyone to keep Trump in office during the difficult time for him of the impeachment and the Mueller investigation. And so William Barr resigned because he would not go forward with the president's desire to do just this, to push the big lie and to seize ballot boxes. So if you have perhaps the most virulent of President Trump supporters saying, "Mr. President, I'm sorry, that goes too far," that should give pause to anyone, I think, who continues to support the former president's activities.
Talking to historian Jeffrey Engel, founding director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University, about the latest on efforts to overturn the 2020 election by President Trump and his closest colleagues. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your reactions to the latest news, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls. Mike is with us in Oconomowoc. Mike, hi.
Hi. It's a great topic. I'm a little concerned that we keep talking about this is what they wanted to do, this is what he wanted to try and do, and unsuccessfully, which there was in reality almost no way for it to happen. I mean, we have such divided government. This isn't a Noriega situation where the guy actually ran the military by himself. So he can't command the military to do anything. He can't command any of these other departments to do anything. He can command individuals, and most of them resigned or rebelled against him. But I think that our narrative here on this whole thing seems to be more that they're trying to prevent him from running again, which is fine with most of us who are more in the center on this country. And yet it's not doing anything legislatively to move this country forward, because there's no threat that an individual president of the United States could ever have in this country. It's almost basic civics.
Mike, thanks for the call. And Jeff, this is, a common argument. Yes, President Trump and his colleagues tried to do these things, but the Secretary of State of Georgia pushed back. The Attorney General pushed back. There were safeguards there. It didn't happen, so the system worked.
You know, I'm really glad that your caller asked this really important question. As he put it, it is basic civics, but there's a hidden step within basic civics that we don't often tell people when we teach them that in school or when we talk about these things openly, and that is that laws only work if people follow them. Chains of command only work if people follow them. As to your caller's point, there were many people who resigned rather than fulfill President Trump's desires in this instance and throughout American history. People who resigned because a president had said something that they thought was illegal or unconstitutional. And the way this typically plays out is that the president keeps on firing people until he finds the guy who will do it. Most famously, actually, you know, Richard Nixon's decision to fire the special investigator of him for Watergate. He fired the first attorney general, then the second, and then finally found somebody who was willing to do that deed, which happened to be Robert Bork, hurt him for his own future in the Supreme Court. So we have to remember that we are, yes, a nation of laws, but we're also a nation of people. And if people choose to not follow the law, or to give them, to be fair, if people choose to follow the person who is in their authority chain of command, who is doing something illegal or wrong, then we have a problem. And as you mentioned, the Secretary of State of Georgia is, I think, a wonderful example of this, that, you know, we have on tape, and I don't know why this, frankly, was not enough to bring more fury down on his head, shall we say, if not legal consequences. We have the President of the United States telling the Secretary of State of Georgia that I need you to find me votes. Imagine if the Secretary of State had said yes. And it's not far-fetched to think of a Secretary of State saying yes, because there are many people running currently to be Secretary of States of their own state around the country who have basically made it their campaign promise that they would have said yes in that moment. So laws only work when good people follow them.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Jeffrey Engel, presidential historian, founding director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University, with us today to talk about some of the new information coming to light about former President Donald Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election outcome. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the former president's interest in having voting machines seized in various states? How about the effort to put forth electors who weren't electors, including here in Wisconsin? Do you have questions about these stories? What do you think they mean for the health of our democracy? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about the aftermath of the 2020 presidential election and new reporting about former President Trump's efforts to stay in power. Jeffrey Engel with Southern Methodist University stays with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. Jeff, before we go back to our callers, I want to bring up a part of the story with a Wisconsin connection. Republicans in seven states that Biden ultimately won had their electors get together and cast ballots. Two of those states, they made them conditional. Like, yeah, we're not the electors unless court rulings determine that Donald Trump won. Five states, including Wisconsin, didn't have that condition. They just said, we're the electors. There are talks of investigation over signing a fraudulent document here. How important is this part of the story?
I think it's an important part of the story, not necessarily from the legal aspect, and I'm not expert enough to speak to the actual legality of what may or may not have been crossing a law line. But the fact that we have people throughout multiple states who are operating in the same way, following the same pattern, doing the same actions to try to use the same deception, that certainly meets the common sense theory of a common sense definition of conspiracy. And to go back to an earlier point that I think one of your callers made, it is absolutely true, thankfully, that President Trump and his efforts to subvert the national will in this election did not work. And one might ask, well, if it didn't work, what's the harm? No harm, no foul, right? So I think we should remind ourselves that, you know, look at this in a different context. If you are planning to rob a bank and begin to try to rob a bank and you get foiled in robbing the bank, you don't walk away scot-free. You know, that's still an illegal act.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Hadi is with us in Madison. Hadi, hi.
Yeah, hi. I like the example your guest just gave. You don't get out of jail because you didn't succeed. That's crazy talk. What I wanted to ask the guest is, can you explain to me how in this world we are not all in the street after what we are seeing? It's impossible that everybody is sitting on his hands. Oh, okay, yeah, let's see what happens. This is crazy. In the United States, you have a president trying to steal and make a coup. Let's call it what it is. It's a coup, attempted coup.
Thanks for the call. Jeff Huddy sees this as a coup. Surprised that the United States, Americans are taking it so calmly.
You know, let me give a counterfactual word of opportunity for people to relax in one sense. As I've said, this is a terrible situation that's going on, but I do think it's important to recognize it could be worse. So right now we have somewhere, depending on your poll, between 50 and 70% of people who declare themselves to be Republicans stating that they believe that the last election was inappropriate, that the last election had some malfeasance, that the last election was in some way not true. We have a smaller percentage who don't believe that Joe Biden is the lawful president, but still almost a majority of Republicans who say that. I would suggest that if Republicans really did think that the wrong person was in jail, they would be in the streets. That if Republican legislators through up and down the party, going all the way up through the Senate and the House, really did think that the wrong person was in the White House, that they would be saying much more and doing much more and arguing much more to not thwart the Democratic agenda in Congress, but rather to thwart the fact that there is a undemocratically elected president. So I think this is a moment where, yes, there are true believers out there. There's no doubt about it. I think President Trump certainly surrounds himself with them. And we've seen that only a few thousand people, as we saw on January 6th, of true believers can cause tremendous mayhem and damage. But I think that the polls that are telling us how many Republicans genuinely believe this stuff are actually not telling us quite the truth. Republicans are saying one thing, but not acting with their feet to demonstrate the other.
Thanks for that call. Go next to Bob in Milwaukee. Bob, hi.
Hi. Hello.
Yes, you're on the air, Bob. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah. Hey. Given the last two calls, I'll change up a little bit, but I'll just say this. What concerns me right now is that I think, obviously, there's at least a small group of people who are indeed out in the streets, and they're out in the streets based on lies that are told to them, and they ironically, they think that they're doing the right thing. They couch it in words like we're patriots trying to protect our country, but they're not patriots. They're brown shirts. And we are in 1939 Germany right now. I mean, we just don't know it. And the Germans, by and large, didn't know it when they were in the 30s either. It's what's coming is real bad. If we don't uphold the law, we might as well not have a law. You know, I mean, if you just decide that, hey, the Packers scored 7 and the Vikings scored 23, but we don't like the Vikings, so we're going to say, hey, the Packers won anyway. That's not a game anymore.
Bob, thanks for the call. Jeff, this is a concern I hear often, that what we saw in the run-up to January 6th on January 6th didn't work then, but it was a dress rehearsal for something worse that might come in the future.
That is actually my concern. And to your caller's point, I have great sympathy for the people in the streets who are protesting, that small number who do believe that they are saving democracy. If I thought that democracy was being threatened by a president who was not supposed to be in office, or if President Trump had been successful, in my opinion, in keeping the office when he shouldn't have, I like to think I would be in the streets too. So I'm sympathetic and I appreciate the patriotism they are trying to demonstrate. But I do think that we need to pay very careful attention to the reports that are coming out, the draft documents. Yes, they're draft documents, but they tell us what people around President Trump were thinking and planning and discussing about what to do, seizing the ballot boxes, declaring emergencies, declaring that the president has the power to essentially keep civil order, and the president could actually impose martial law, according to the man who was going to be his national security advisor, actually was his first national security advisor for a few weeks, General Michael Flynn, suggested that President Trump should impose martial law to get his processes done. And frankly, these were last minute haphazard ideas because that most of them were formulated after President Trump had lost the election. I frankly think that if the president had been willing to believe that he was going to lose ahead of time, and the people around him as well, if they had put a lot more thought and a lot more planning into how they were going to do this with months in advance to prep, then we'd have a different story. So we now have years for people to prep for the next opportunity. And as to go back to the earlier caller's point, It's a trite thing to say, but it could not be more true. The fundamental element of American civic life is that it requires good people following the law, period. Without that, we have different problems.
Bob, thanks for the call. And just our last minute and a half or so, Jeff, are there guardrails that you think we could put into place that would help prevent these things?
I think transparency is good. The more that we have open, transparent elections, not elections necessarily that where people find it more difficult to vote, but we can have a better sense of what votes actually look like, would be helpful. But I actually have to say that one surprising change in my mind, surprising to me, of what's happened after the election has been my desire to approve suddenly of the Electoral College and of the diffuse nature of the way that we elect presidents. I had previously argued that the Electoral College was undemocratic, and I think it is. I think it disenfranchises voters who come from particular states and helps voters who come from smaller states in particular to have greater power. But that's a necessary flaw, I think, for what the Electoral College and our diffuse system actually gave us after January 6th, which was an opportunity for individuals to make that right call. The Secretary of State of Georgia and of other states to be able to actually follow the law, not just what their party superiors were telling them. I think we'd have a different scenario if you take the hypothetical that we have a national election, one campaign, one election, one ballot box, if you will, and the person who is in charge of counting the votes actually reports to the President of the United States. I think we would have had a different scenario. So the fact that the Secretary of State of Georgia could rightly say to the President of the United States, "Sir, I don't work for you," is a really important safeguard in itself. So as Congress considers future changes, I do hope that they will keep the diffuse nature of the 50 different elections, even though, as I said, that's not something I would have anticipated myself saying 6 months ago.
Jeff, thanks again for joining us today.
It's good to talk to you. Hope to talk to you on happier circumstances next time.
That's Jeffrey Engel, history professor, founding director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University, with the latest on the 2020 election.